A Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
Kia ora. Morena koutou and haere mai. My name is Seb.
My name is Nico.
And you are listening to your new 11 AM weekly R1 Tuesday news show here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi 91 Radio 1 FM. Coming up on the program I tēnei rā, we spoke to some of the students who attended the annual North Dunedin street cleanup in memory of Sophia Cristani, which happened last Friday. After that, we take a look at why the media is falling behind when it comes to covering climate issues. We spoke to environmental sociologist Kirsty Wild, as well as journalist and editor of North and South, Kirsty Cameron.
Following that, we have our third installment of our small business segment, Local Legends. This week, I spoke to Sophie, local legend and owner of the brand new Korean restaurant and lunch spot, Rice Plus Cake, or Rice Cake. And to end the show with an informative and adventurous twist, we will be joined live, in fact, for our second edition of Creature of the Week with Andrew Johnston, who will be talking to us about the Royal Northern Albatross.
But before all that, here is Kero Kero Bonito with their song Flamingo. Stay locked.
How many shrimps do you have to eat before you make your skin turn pink? Eat too much and you'll get sick. Shrimps are pretty rich. あいつらはピンク動物園で思ったピンク食べ物でそうなんだ実は私はタラコが大好きプラスエビカニ食べようピンク色になるのだからみんな違う色人間って勘違いしてるよね Black, white, green or blue Show off your natural hue Flamingo Oh, 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 oh If you're multicolored, that's cool too You don't need to change It's boring being the same Flamingo Oh, 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 oh You're pretty either way 鶴の尻尾下に向かって曲げたらフラミンゴ意味不明だけど面白いでしょ虹色に染まった世界今日も地球のどこかでエビをむしゃむしゃ食べてフラミンゴはピンク色に染まっていくぜ 1, 2, 3 Black, white, green or blue Show off your natural hue Flamingo, oh, 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 oh If you're multicolored, that's cool too You don't need to change It's boring being the same Flamingo, oh, 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 oh You're pretty either way Shrimps do you have to eat before you make your skin turn pink? Eat too much and you'll get sick. Shrimps are pretty rich. Green or blue, show off your natural hue. Flamingo, oh, 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 oh. If you're multicolored, that's cool too. You don't need to change. It's boring being the same. Flamingo, oh, 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 oh.
You are listening to R1 News here on Radio 1. That song you just heard was Kero Kero Bonito. It was by Kero Kero Bonito. The song was called Flamingo.
Such a good song.
Great song. Yeah. The time is 8 minutes past 11. Last Friday, I went down to the annual North Dunedin street cleanup, which was held in memory of Sophia Cristani, to talk to some of the student volunteers down there about what the cleanup meant to them.
Last Friday, a group of over 100 students took part in a street cleanup organised in memory of Sophia Cristani, a Dunedin student who died in a stairwell stampede at a Dundas Street flat party in 2019. Following her tragic passing, a multi-agency agreement known as the Sophia Charter was created and signed by stakeholders from the University of Otago, Emergency Services, the Dunedin City Council and the OUSA. It was hoped that the launch of a charter in her memory would improve student safety and well-being in North Dunedin. The street cleanup, which was organised in line with the Sophia Charter, was carried out in some of North Dunedin's most notorious party streets, namely Castle Street, Leith Street and some of the adjoining streets. Megan Prentice, who was one of Sophia's closest friends, had this to say on who Sophia was and the kind of impression that she left on the community.
Sophia was my best friend. We met at school. And I think everyone who knew her would describe her as like the kind of girl who would literally, I know this sounds so cliche, but she literally would light up a room. Like she had this laugh that was just so infectious, and she was just so, she fiercely loved her friends, and she, you know, she worked hard, played hard. So she was studying maths and stats at uni. She was bloody smart, like really, really smart girl. Yeah, she loved being around kids. She was a gym coach. Yeah, she just was an amazing, bubbly queen.
After talking to some of the students at the cleanup, it became clear that Sophia's memory is still very present in the wider community, and some of the values set out by the Sophia Charter are still being upheld. Some of the students I spoke to echoed Megan's sentiments and talked on the loss that was widely felt throughout the student body.
She was just like classic, gorgeous, lovely, yeah. Always a light in a room.
Yeah.
Just one of the girls always, and it's such a big loss now.
Yeah.
Especially in Dunedin, yeah. It's definitely felt still nowadays. Yeah.
She had so much time for everyone. Like, I know her super well, but always so nice to like see her.
So a street cleanup is quite fitting for kind of helping remember Sophia.
Yeah. Definitely nice to like get together in a practical way as well to, you know, remember her and everyone. Everyone can join in. Like, I think we've got a few hundred people here today, so it's awesome. Good to all come together as one.
This was the third official North Dunedin street cleanup held in memory of Sophia. When asked about the successful turnout, one student had this to say.
The amount of people that turn out for an event like this is just a testament to that. You know, I know how much her friends loved her and, you know, kind of wanted to leave a permanent kind of legacy, I think, which is important. You know, to continue doing really good stuff like this in her name. So I think, yeah.
The student quarter of Dunedin has established a poor reputation for itself when it comes to cleanliness and respect towards public spaces. While the street cleanup will help in the immediate sense, students are apprehensively hopeful that it will have a more long-term impact on the way students conduct themselves in the areas that they inhabit. When asked whether these streets will remain clean for long after the cleanup, the responses were hesitant at best.
That's a big question. I'll just have to wait until next year's cleanup.
We'll wait and see.
I mean, you hope so. That's the goal. But we'll see when it comes to kind of.
Yeah, we're all young once, and we make our own mess, don't we?
Yeah, exactly. But I think, you know, if people have done the hard work and they've actually personally helped clean it up, like there might not be so much of an incentive to kick a bin over or, you know, anything like that. So hopefully.
One of the students I talked to believed that the reputation that these so-called party streets receive can often be a little harsh.
I think everyone forgets that they were once a kid. You know, everyone likes to point the finger. It's like, oh, you know, so unorganised and messy. But, I mean, I'm sure they weren't as kids. It's easier to point fingers about what it used to be when you're younger. Yeah. But everyone goes through a phase.
Yeah.
It's nice to see that everyone's actually doing stuff instead of not really caring.
Overall, the significant turnout and the removal of large amounts of rubbish and broken glass left the attendees feeling like the day was a successful and meaningful way to honour Sophia Cristani.
That was Sib, joined by volunteers at the Sophia Cristani cleanup, speaking on the Sophia Cristani Charter and cleanup that happened last Friday in memory of Sophia.
Coming up on the show, we're talking about how the media is lacking when it comes to talking about climate issues with environmental sociologist Kirsty Wild and Kirsty Cameron, the editor of North and South magazine. But first, here is Erykah Badu with the song Window Seat. Kia ora. My name is Seb and you are listening to your weekly Radio 1 news show here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. That song was Erykah Badu with Window Seat. Time is 18 minutes past 11. Earlier this week, I was joined by environmental sociologist Kirsty Wild and North and South magazine editor Kirsty Cameron to discuss how climate change is being underrepresented in the media, which is especially concerning in light of the latest IPCC report.
Last week, on the 5th of April, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the world's leading climate science organization, released its latest mitigation report. It looked at more than 18,000 pieces of evidence, with this evidence being reviewed by the authors of the report, some 278 climate scientists from around the globe. The report, being the third major release from the IPCC, focused on greenhouse gas emissions cuts, what has happened to date and what is necessary from here. Many of the findings of the report cast a grim picture of what awaits us in the coming century without radical action. The report found that even if all the policies to cut carbon that governments had put in place by the end of 2020 were fully implemented, the world would still warm by 3.2 degrees Celsius this century. According to the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, that sort of temperature rise would see our planet hit by unprecedented heat waves, terrifying storms, and widespread water shortages. In order to avoid that fate, researchers from the IPCC say that the world must keep the rise in temperatures at or under 1.5 degrees Celsius this century. The latest IPCC summary also shows how that can be done in what Mr. Guterres calls a viable and financially sound manner. However, keeping temperatures down will require massive changes to energy production, industry, transport, our consumption patterns, and the way we treat nature. The report received international coverage the day it was released, but has since begun to disappear from the news cycle. This has recently sparked some debate over whether media companies are addressing the issue of climate change as frequently and comprehensively as they ought to be. There have been various commitments from New Zealand media outlets to take the threat of climate change more seriously. For example, in 2019, Stuff, the New Zealand Herald, TVNZ, RNZ Newsroom and The Spin-off took part in a week of special climate change coverage for the event Covering Climate Now. However, it seems to be that whenever central or local governments make moves to reform transport or housing to fall in line with IPCC recommendations, coverage tends to be framed in very negative terms. When the Herald announced in November last year that the Auckland Council was drawing up a plan to remove parking on many of the city's roads to make way for more bus lanes and cycleways, the plan was framed as radical and was followed up by a story focusing on the business concerns of the plan. When compared with many European cities' plans to create large networks of urban cycleways, the Auckland Council's proposal is actually quite modest in relativity. Cyclists and their rights as road users are increasingly downplayed by media outlets when they report on vehicles impacting cyclists, with language that often underreports the driver's culpability. When the media covers stories on attempts to build bike paths or any other facilities to help interrupt the regular incidents of cyclist deaths, it will generally report it through a negative lens, often disparaging the people calling for increased safety measures. When cyclists blocked Auckland's Harbour Bridge last year to call for a cycle lane to Auckland's North Shore, Newstalk ZB's Kerry McIver compared the cyclists to rodents.
If you've seen the mice in Australia, you know, the hordes of mice sweeping through the farms, if you can imagine mice in lycra and on bikes, that's what they look like. The swarm of them.
Kirsty Wild is an environmental sociologist at the University of Auckland whose research primarily involves transport and how it affects public health. Wild believes that the difficult topic of climate change is slowly beginning to enter the public consciousness. However, New Zealand media outlets have much further to go.
We are seeing the media sort of become much more comfortable with saying the science is kind of settled, this is happening, you know, we do need to do something about it. But we haven't really seen the media engage properly yet with the solutions. That's still kind of treated like maybe that's not a settled science. Maybe there's a, you know, it's all up in the air. Oh, what do we do about it? You know, whereas actually, I mean, with the latest IPCC report, as scientists, we're pretty settled on what the solutions are.
Wild says that when it comes to climate change coverage, the media tend to report much more on the negative side of things, which does more to obscure and trivialise the issue than to really address it.
It's about how inconvenient it's going to be, you know, and how tough it's going to be, and, you know, the idea that it'll destroy businesses and you know, I'm a public health researcher, so it actually kind of is pretty similar, whatever issue you talk about, those same things come up. You know, it'll destroy businesses to not have single-use plastic bags. It'll destroy businesses to not have smoking in bars. You know, there's a pretty similar narrative. But, you know, we've got this really big, urgent thing in front of us, and these things almost never come to pass. You know, if you move the parking, people will walk round the corner. You know, it's very unlikely it's going to destroy people's businesses. In fact, you know, all the research suggests that it generally doesn't have much effect at all, or sometimes even it has a positive effect.
An alternative which Wild offers is that it is far more important to focus on the benefits that climate change mitigation will bring about, as opposed to just focusing on the negative and emotional reactions to these required changes.
There's a lot of focus on people's anxieties, and it's kind of understandable, but also there's just heaps of positive stuff that can come out of this. Like, our two big issues in New Zealand are agriculture and transport in terms of emissions, and so changing to more plant-based diets and, you know, driving less and walking and cycling more, they're the big things that we need to be doing for climate. They're also two of the really big things that we need to be doing for health. You know, the reason why our hospitals are kind of full all the time, we've been faced with that reality with COVID, is kind of poor diet and not getting enough exercise are big parts of that. So there's just huge gains for us, and the media tends to focus on the short-term inconvenience over the real possibilities in terms of health and climate gains.
Wild believes that there are plenty of good examples of successful climate change mitigation tactics that New Zealand is already seeing that could quite easily be highlighted by the media instead of focusing on the topic through the lens of fear.
I think I've said before that we're getting presented with all these scary stories about climate change, and then we're getting presented with all these scary stories about the solutions to climate change, and it's just all scary and it feels like nothing is possible. And we already have, you know, in New Zealand and Aotearoa, we already have some fantastic success stories. I mean, in Auckland, where I am, where a lot of this negative media coverage has been lately, we don't have high levels of cycling or public transport, but we already have a cycling superstar in Otatahi, where levels of cycling are at the point where Auckland aims to get to by 2030. Wellington is a public transport superstar. So we already have heaps of good examples of where the stuff is working, and life has gone on and businesses haven't been destroyed. Yeah.
Even disregarding the projections of the latest IPCC report, Wild argues that the way things are now is far from ideal, and that ultimately a better way for the media to frame the issue of climate change is to convey that it actually provides us with an opportunity for the improvement of society.
There's lots of things about life in our cities which are not that great. And if we do things like intensify housing, like bring home and work together, that will make housing a lot cheaper. And it will mean that more people can afford housing, and we can do something about the fact that 1 in 100 New Zealanders are now homeless. More walking and cycling, while people tend to like their neighbourhoods more if there's more walking and cycling, our cities are less noisy, you get better sleep, you tend to be healthier, tend to have better mental health where you've got more walking and cycling. These are all things that people tend to enjoy. It's just getting over that, you know, anxiety and stress about change. But, you know, climate change is pretty stressful. I think it's helpful for the media to give us some sense of what's the really important thing to be worrying about here. You know, is being asked to walk 5 for climate round the corner as scary as what's coming in terms of climate change? You know, which is the really scary one? You know, I think it's important to acknowledge that, you know, things there are some things about getting on with addressing climate change are going to be annoying. There's no doubt about it. And there'll be a period where, you know, we have to adjust. But actually, I mean, I don't know how bad it is in Dunedin, but we have some of the worst congestion in the Asia-Pacific region and in Auckland, and it's already pretty awful. You know, like life is not that great. You know, there's lots of opportunities to make it heaps better through at the same time as addressing climate change.
Kirsty Cameron is the editor for popular New Zealand magazine North and South. She says that climate change pertains to almost every story that is covered, and it is the obligation of New Zealand journalists to present objective facts, regardless of their personal opinions or biases.
I think you can quite reasonably say there's possibly not a story you do now that doesn't involve some aspect of climate change. And it's really important to reflect that. So it comes up in all sorts of areas, not necessarily just stories about something like carbon credits and what's going on there. It's the job of a reporter to present the facts. Doesn't matter whether they agree with them or disagree with them. They're presenting the views of the source they have interviewed, and in which case this report has been published, this is what it says. Where opinion comes in is them either asking for opinion, or if they are an opinion writer, which is quite different to being an everyday news journalist, well, obviously they would bring their opinion to it.
Cameron also says that analysis of adverse weather events shouldn't be the responsibility of every member of a news team. However, media outlets should do their very best to provide expert opinion on these issues wherever they can.
It's possibly a little bit different for, you know, Dan the weatherman on One News, who is a trained meteorologist. Now, he's almost in the role of a journalist. He's presenting the facts. They're looking at the radar reports, they're reading reports, they're analysing and saying, this high is about to blow in, this low is coming up over the South Island. So it's not, I would think, his role to say, and the climate, you know, this is because of climate change, or the what we're seeing is the impact of climate change. But it's certainly the role of the wider news team to look at the things that are playing into weather and events, you know, like the fires we have in the Southland at the moment. Look at the weather that's just, absolutely tormented Australia's east coast. That has a bit to do with climate change. Absolutely. So I think, the role of the media is to present these facts and to find experts who can explain the whys and hows of it in a way that anybody, you know, reading or listening can understand.
That was Seb talking to environmental sociologist Kirsty Wild and editor of North and South magazine, Kirsty Cameron, discussing some of the reasons of how and why they're represented in the media. Next on the show, we have our third installment of our segment, Local Legends, where each week we talk to a different local legend on their business or creative project that stands out on the Dunedin scene or makes an impact on the Dunedin community. This week, I talked to Sophie, owner of Rice and Cake. But first, here is Aldous Harding with Fever.
Living
Kia ora, I'm Nika, and you're listening to the Radio 1 News Show. It is currently 33 minutes past 11. Just playing was Aldous Harding with Fever. And now coming up, we have our third installment of our segment, Local Legends. And this morning, I had the absolute pleasure of talking to Sophie, a local legend and owner of the new Korean restaurant, Rice Plus Cake. Let's take a listen now. Good morning, Sophie. How are you this morning?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Great, I'm great. Thank you so much for joining me. I just have a couple questions to ask you as a local legend here in the Dunedin scene. So you are the owner of Rice Cake, or Rice Plus Cake. How long have you been open at the moment? Because you're relatively new on the Dunedin food scene, if I'm right.
Yeah, so we actually opened late February, but then we had to, like, close for, like, 2 weeks or so because we had COVID.
Oh, my gosh.
So we actually haven't been operating for very long.
But it's good, though, that you're open now and ready to rumble. And what inspired you to start this restaurant? Because I understand that it was owned by your dad?
Yeah, it was. So, my family and my brother Richard owns Mega Hustle on George Street, and I've actually worked in with him and our family in the hospitality sector for about 10 years, and, like, the opportunity came up for me to, you know, start my own small business, and I'm like, yes.
Yeah, that's incredible. It's really cool just, like, knowing that, because I've got a couple of friends, because we love Mega Hustle, and when we saw that your one opened up, we're like, are you kidding? There's another one? This is so nuts. No, very exciting. That's cool. So you always knew that you wanted to go into cooking and, like, open maybe a restaurant of your own?
Yeah, I've always loved cooking. And, like, yeah, I've worked in the hospitality for so long that I kind of, like, this is what I wanted to do.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. And is it fun being in the same industry as your family as well, being able to, like, almost have a small kind of community of people that do operate a business and do Korean cuisine as well?
Yes, definitely. Because, I get a lot of support and help from Richard, my brother. Like, he's actually, like, pretty much guided me through the whole, like, opening menus and, you know, those things. And, yeah, we're just so helpful. Yeah, and it's just great having kind of, like, a mentor. I think I would have been able to do it, like, completely on my own.
It's very good, though, that you have that support, which is amazing. And I just have one final question. So everyone listening as well, because obviously we can't see the menu right now on radio. So what is a must-have meal at Rice Cake, or what would you recommend to someone walking in the doors for the first time?
Definitely tteokbokki, which is, like, a sweet and, like, a spicy soup, and it's, like, the main ingredient is, like, rice cake, also called duck. Yeah, so it's, like, it's perfect for winter, like, when you're feeling, like, you need something hot and spicy, warms you up.
Look, especially on a day like today, I think it's quite chilly outside.
Yeah, it's also, like, my favourite food ever.
That's perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You got it tuned to the Tuesday News Show here on Radio 1. You just listened to Nico talking to Sophie of the new restaurant Rice and Cake down across from New World by Albion Place. Haven't been there yet, but I'm a huge fan of Mega Hustle, which is a family restaurant owned by the brother of Sophie. And so I don't doubt that flavor runs in the family in that one. So, yeah, check it out if you can. That was our local legend segment where we highlight really awesome local businesses going around the community. But right now we're going to play you a song before we talk to Andrew Johnston, the budding zoologist, who's going to be talking to us about the albatross this week for Creature of the Week. So stay tuned for that. But for now, this is Flamingo Pier with the song Hold It. Thanks for tuning in. You got it locked to Radio 1. This is the Tuesday News Show. I'm Seb.
I'm Nico.
And the time is 11 minutes to 12. The song you just listened to there was Lawrence Arabia with One Unique Creature. Now it's time for a very exciting part of our show. It's the Creature of the Week segment, where each week we get on the budding zoologist Andrew Johnston to come talk to us about a creature... a local creature that he has had spent some time
studying, observing.
This week, Andy, what are we talking about, man?
Yeah, g'day. So this week, I was looking around the news and the royal albatross popped up. So I actually went out to the colony.
Gorgeous. The Toroa?
That's right. Yeah, the Toroa. Yeah.
Cool, man. Before we start talking about the Toroa, could you tell us a bit about yourself and what your experience is with zoology, wildlife management? What's your stick, man?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, I'm Andy Johnston. I've done a degree in zoology here at Otago. I'm currently doing a master's in wildlife management. I'm looking at the Mahua Nui giant wetter, which is one of our species here. And I'm just absolutely love the wildlife here in Old Bolte, Dunedin. Love going around doing little adventures and checking them all out and stuff. Yeah, it's absolutely gorgeous.
What a place to be as a zoologist, eh?
Yeah, they call it the wildlife capital of New Zealand.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I'm pretty sure David Attenborough came through here once, and he reckoned the Otago Peninsula was one of the most sprawling with life.
Absolutely. There's actually a quote from him on the Royal Albatross page.
Oh, really?
About how amazing the place is, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
So to start us off about the Royal Albatross, obviously they're beautiful creatures and quite a rarity to see outside of the Otago Peninsula, if I'm right. But what are some fun facts about the Northern Royal Albatross, like their breeding pattern or flight patterns?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Northern Royal Albatross are just amazing. So the place we've got here in Dunedin is the only mainland breeding colony for this Royal Albatross in the world. So it's the only place they come to breed. And they're the third largest of the 23 albatross species. So when you think of albatross, you usually think of the wandering albatross, you know, which goes around and has a huge wingspan. And this is the third largest. So it has a 3-meter wingspan. So it's pretty big.
Massive.
That is big.
Yeah, so they come here into Dunedin and that's where they lay their eggs. So when they come to land in Dunedin, that's the only time that they actually spend time on land. Otherwise, this bird lives entirely in the ocean.
What?
Yeah. So they live in the ocean. They
just floating?
Like the surface?
Yeah, yeah. So they're flying from here to South America, to Chile, and back again. So that's their flight patterns. They can take, if they're going from here to Chile, they can take, 12 to 30 days. And it's about a 9,000-kilometer trip to get there. So once they're there, and then they come back to Dunedin to lay their eggs. And so the male and the female will sit on the eggs for about 11 weeks to keep it warm, and they'll take turns flying off to get some food and come back, and they'll swap who's staying on the eggs. And then they will guard the chick for about 5 to 6 weeks until it's fully fledged at 8 months old. And then from there, the juvenile will kind of go on this trip for 8 years.
It will go to Chile. So yep. All these chicks are going to head to Chile one day.
Yeah, they're going to do the
big, exact same thing.
The big fly, yeah.
And this behavior, this isn't taught. They just somehow know.
Exactly.
This is what trips me out.
Yeah.
How do they know how and where to go?
That's honestly a million-dollar question. If you can figure that out, then you'll be.
Do they follow their parents? Do they go like? Are they like, come on, kids, let's go this way, or do they just like on their own accord, just be like, sweet, I know the wind direction, we're going this way?
Yeah, they just seem to know. So a while ago, people thought it might be something to do with magnetic fields and whatnot, but that's since been disproven. So now they're thinking it's something to do with like the wind currents and the ocean currents and following smells or that kind of thing. But yeah, no one really knows. They go off and they do this trip.
That's insane.
Yeah,
that's insane. And so I'm tripping out at the fact that they live on the surface of the water.
Yeah.
So they're obviously eating fish.
Yep. Yeah, they're eating squid. They're usually hunting at night, so their eyes are really well adapted to nighttime. So at night, that's when most of the fish come up to the surface and they can do their hunting. Yeah.
Oh,
they actually got a special organ in their head because they're eating so much seafood. It's very salty, a lot of salt water.
Yeah.
They got a special organ that excretes all the salt from their diet, and then they sort of get it, they remove it through their nostrils. So Whoa. It basically allows them to have such a high salt diet, which would usually kill any other species.
Yeah. And so, Andy, you recently went to the Albatross Centre out at, is it Harrington Point? Out on the peninsula?
Tairoa Heads.
Can you tell us a bit about that? What was the centre like?
It's incredible, right? It's awesome. So when you go, you get your ticket, and then they'll take you to a few different viewing platforms. And at the moment, if you go, you can see the like fluffy white chicks of these albatross, which is really, really, really sweet. Yeah. So I went and we saw all the birds flying around and just soaring. It's a very like amazing experience. But the place there, they do really well. They've got amazing pest control. Maybe the oldest pest controlled area in New Zealand.
Wow.
So they've been keeping care of these animals for a long time. They've got their own hospital to look after these animals as well.
Wow.
And the area is actually somewhat too hot for the albatross, because usually they're a bit more subantarctic. So what they've done is they've put up sprinkler systems around all the nests so that they can spray them with water to keep them cool enough. So they're doing an amazing job looking after these guys.
So you say it's too hot where they are out at Tairoa Heads, but is it... So is it an entirely man-made colony, or were they naturally there?
Naturally, I guess, coming there and back, but it's just been more and more favourable for them, seeing as it's an area that has had less pests in it and stuff.
Right.
It's an area they're able to reproduce in.
Yeah. Right. Incredible.
Yeah.
And you got a tour, you got a private tour.
You can go out there, you can get an hour tour. So the guy I went around with was super knowledgeable in them and super passionate as well.
Yeah.
That's the thing about all these places, that everyone that works there is so incredibly passionate about their species. Really wants them to thrive.
Andy, can you tell us a bit about the albatross's cultural significance?
Absolutely.
To whatever culture they encounter, because I guess if they're going to Chile as well, there's
stuff there. So the actual where the colony is now used to be an old Maori tar site. There has been a bit of significance with the Maori as well. So they would often use their feathers, the feathers of the albatross, of the toro, to make the cloaks, the korowai, for their cultural. And it's also been having a bit of a cultural significance with sailors as well. You know, if you're out at sea and a albatross lands on your boat, that's good luck, but then it's bad luck if you kill the albatross that's on your boat. And there's quite a bit of a mythology around them as well.
Have you seen that film, The Lighthouse?
With Robert Pattinson.
There's a scene to do with a seagull.
I won't spoil it.
Don't bring that up right now.
And how are the Royal Albatross doing in terms of their and their status in terms of conservation? Are they endangered? Are they threatened?
I think they're classified as they're classified as naturally uncommon. So just they're not necessarily endangered per se, but they're just a very rare species.
They're
very, very unique in what they are. They're at the moment, I think they've only got... I have to double check how many fledglings they have at the site. But when we were there, we saw maybe about 10 or so.
So they're doing relatively well.
I mean, they're well looked after there. They're affected by a lot of things that most of animals at the moment are affected by. Such as things as climate change, and there's some pretty horrific photos on the internet of them eating plastic and rubbish and whatnot. You know, because they mistake it for a fish or mistake it for something like that, which could be a big issue. But at the moment, they're doing okay.
What are some of the things that we can do as responsible citizens to help protect these beautiful creatures?
I think the thing that is the easiest thing to do is just to go and see them at the colony and go and buy a ticket, which all the money goes towards helping them and making sure that they're okay. And what you get out of it is well worth it. You actually get to see an encounter with these animals and like, get this kind of feeling, this emotion of connecting with them and seeing their young and seeing them fly around and soar around just connect. So I think the best thing we can do, is, because it's such a unique, isolated population, go and see them, go support it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Go marvel at their beauty. Are they really big? Are they like...
Yeah, so 3 meter long wingspans, right? So
3 meters. That's taller than any human.
Oh, yeah. Big time.
Wow. Oh my gosh, we're going to have to check this place out, Nico. The Royal Albatross Centre out at Tairoa Head.
Yeah.
definitely.
It's actually Nico's birthday today, everyone. I'm going to do a subtle plug there.
Hey, birthday.
Do you want to be your birthday present? I'll take you out there.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'd love that. That would be very crazy. I've got one final question, though, as well, because I was just thinking about it when you were talking about them just living and chilling in the water. Mm-hmm. Do they sleep? How do they sleep? Because, like, what if they're, like, again, like, about to snooze and then, like, a big wave comes?
The big wave comes,
I'm very concerned about their sleeping.
I'm not fully sure, but we did learn something about them. They don't take long rests. They only take short little naps to sort of kind of get their mind working again. So they only sleep in very short intervals, while on water.
Right. How crazy. Can you tell us any little fun facts before we wrap this up?
Before we wrap this up, well, I think that the most amazing thing, really, about them is their flight patterns, you know, their flight trips and stuff. But some amazing facts about the place itself, the colony, is that they have their royal cam, you know, that's live streamed all the time.
Yes.
So you can watch, you know, the birds, you can watch the fledglings, you can watch all those kind of things. And something else they have at the colony is that there's actually two female breeding pair. There's two females. Royal albatross mate for life. So they stay together with the pair they bond with, and two females have decided to bond together. So one of them has a little boyfriend on the side that goes in and has the
polyamorous. Yeah, that's great.
That comes back she raises the egg with her female.
That's gorgeous.
Life mate, yeah.
That's so funny. Do you know about Bill and Bill, the two university ducks?
Yeah. So it definitely happens.
They broke up, but now they're back together.
Oh, good.
One of the bills went off for a bit on a little adventure but came back.
Dramatic saga of avian relationships.
Yeah.
How good. Hey, Andrew, thank you so much for gracing us with your knowledge once again, mate. We're loving Creature of the Week. It's my favourite part of the show.
Oh, thank you. I'm loving it too.
Can't wait for next week. Mm-hmm. Do we have any ideas for what we might be talking about?
Well, I think you'll just have to stay tuned and see what it is. Yeah.
Nice.
Keep in suspense.
Bait him. All right. All right, everyone, that comes to the very end of the Radio 1 News Show with Seb and Nico. Thanks for joining in.
Yeah, thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Catch you next week. We're going to leave you with the song Mads Harriet. This is her song, Time. See you next time, everyone. We'll be right back.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more at r1.co.nz or wherever quality content is found.